say, what the devil is all the fuss about? I don't get it. What's in there? Bing bong! Hello!
I don't want to hear any of that politically correct rooster.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason, and we're ready for you. 1-800-227-5278 is my number, and I am live and lively this weekend. Back from, all kinds of places. Where was I? Oh, I was up in Alaska, I guess, for the last couple of weeks. And glad to be back with you to talk with you about the important things of life, ethics, values, and religion. Offering a defense for classical Christianity and classical Christian values, my goal here, of course, in Stand to Reason, is to give me a piece, is to give you a piece of my mind, and have you give me a piece of yours. And that's why I gave you the number, 1-800-227-5278. Coast to coast, and I understand even internationally that's work seems to be working now. So if you are listening through live streaming at www.kbrt740.com, or if you are listening through through podcasting, and you know that our live show is on Sundays from 3 to 5 and are calling in right now or thinking about doing it, you can do that at that 800 number, or you can dial direct to the 714 number, 754-4150. Lines are open there. And I have some things I want to talk to you about. I want to start out by reading the introduction of a wonderful little book written by a friend of ours and yours, I suspect, Hugh Hewitt. And this is a book that we actually interviewed Hugh on a couple of years ago when it first came out. It's entitled In But Not Of. And here's the way he starts this, pardon me, fine little book that is a kind of a primer on how to have an impact in the culture as a good ambassador. Now, he doesn't use the word ambassador, but it's really what he's after. And if you want to have an impact, if you want to make a difference as a follower of Jesus Christ, as an ambassador for Christ, he's got 48 chapters describing why each is a short vignette with a different lesson. But he starts out the book this way, because his point here will have application to the current events issue I want to make comment on as we start the show. He writes, if it's true, as Jesus said it is, that he is the way, the truth, and the life, no one comes to the Father except through me, quoting here from John 14:6, pardon me, then salvation, happiness for infinity, depends upon the ability of individuals to hear the gospel. The effective and mass communication of the gospel, he writes, depends upon the freedom to proclaim it. Though it's possible to proclaim the gospel in the face of persecution, the unfettered freedom to do so is much, much to be preferred. There are billions of souls who are up for eternal grabs, so the unfettered ability to reach them with the good news is a great and wonderful thing, hard to create and difficult to defend. The creation and defense of religious liberty requires men and women with power and influence in the world. Close quote. And he continues in the preface, explaining the reason for writing the book, which is to help guide those who want to have power and influence in the world to secure religious liberty so that the gospel can be proclaimed most effectively. And this is, of course, a heritage of this country, the religious liberty that we have that allows us to pursue religion aggressively and to proclaim it freely. One of the things that's made this country great. But, of course, this requires watchmen on the walls, as it were, to make sure that that liberty is not curtailed. And it seems like every time you turn around in this country, there is an effort or there is something going on that undermines that liberty or threats to undermine it. And if that liberty is undermined, the gospel cannot go forth as aggressively as it might have, and this has eternal consequences. This is why, by the way, I think Paul, the Apostle Paul, writes in 1 Timothy chapter 2 that we are to pray together for governments, all those who are in power, so that we can lead a peaceful life in all dignity. Let me get the exact wording here. First of all, then, I urge that entreaties and prayers, petitions and thanksgivings be made on behalf of all men, for kings and all who are in authority, in order that we may lead a tranquil and quiet life in all godliness and dignity. Now, does he mean we should pray that people leave us alone? No, I don't think that's his point. The next verse says, this is a good and acceptable thing in the sight of our God and Savior, who desires all men to be saved and come to the knowledge of the truth, for there's one God and one mediator between God and men, the man Jesus Christ. So the idea here in chapter 2 of 1 Timothy is that we are praying for stability and tranquility, that we could lead godly lives without interference of government, so that this gospel message, which entails that only Jesus is the mediator, can go forth to men and women who need it. Now, with that in mind, this issue is in the news once again. The cross on the hill down in San Diego County, it's the Mount Soledad cross. I've seen it many times. If you head down the 5 from L.A. to San Diego, you can see high on a cross, or rather high on the hill, this huge cross that is somewhat of a beacon there as you come through the pass at Mount Soledad. I think there's a church right there, too, that we've been to a few times. And this was erected in 1954, but it's created some consternation of late. In fact, there is one atheist who's been working for 17 years to have the cross removed from public land. Apparently, there was a judge's order to remove it, and then Justice Kennedy put a stay on that from the U.S. Supreme Court until they consider whether they're going to hear the case or not. And apparently, there have been some rulings in the past that the government can't have crosses on its land. Allegedly, I think it was originally erected because that hill was used for Easter services, sunrise services, and then the cross was put up and never taken down. Now, the city wants it up, San Diego, and their argument is that it's a war memorial, not just a religious symbol, and that it's a kind of what do they call those things, a landmark. And so it really has cultural significance and not religious significance, and therefore it does not fall under the purview of the kind of restrictions that the First Amendment and the concept of separation of church and state govern, I guess is the best way to put it. And but, of course, the plaintiffs argue that, and I'm quoting here from the San Diego attorney, James McElroy, who is representing a military veteran and an atheist who's been on this, dogging this trail for 17 years. He says, it's such a strong religious symbol, it shows a governmental preference for that religion over all others. So he thinks that the symbol on the land that is owned by the government indicates a government preference for that which stands behind the symbol, and this is an unconstitutional violation of the separation of church and state. Now, these kinds of things trouble me. On the one hand, I don't like getting involved in these fights because these are the kind of fundy fights I like to avoid. I mean, fundy, like fundamentalists. It's the kind of issues that fundamentalists get all upset about and atheists get all upset about, and everybody screams about these things. And I'm not sure much progress is made. But I do think that behind the struggle, there's something else that's going on that everybody, religious or otherwise, should be concerned about. And this is especially the case for Christians because it has to do with the Bill of Rights. The complaint here has to do with the Bill of Rights, specifically the First Amendment, and the atheist is complaining that the Bill of Rights are being violated and therefore his rights are being violated. Now, I just want to ask you to reflect on something for a moment because I think these sound like complicated issues that turn out not to be that complicated at all. But something is complicating the issue that ought to concern you. I mean, the First Amendment is pretty simple. It was meant to be. Just read it. I don't know if you've read it recently, but I'll read it for you. The First Amendment. In other words, this is the Bill of Rights and the very first entry in the Bill of Rights. The Constitution was amended way back when with the promise that this Bill of Rights, I should say the Constitution was signed with the expectation that this Bill of Rights would be passed, and so here are the human rights that are secured by our Constitution, the First Amendment, amendment about personal freedoms, and the first freedom is the freedom of religion. It reads, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Semicolon. In other words, kind of a new topic, but not much. Or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. Semicolon. Or of the right of the people to peaceably assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances. Now, I want to just make an observation here. The Bill of Rights is a guarantee of freedom. And the first freedom that's protected, before the freedom of speech or press, before the freedom of assembly and petitioning the government, is the freedom of religion. So the most important freedom in the amendments protecting freedoms, particularly the first one, is the freedom of religion. It is a freedom of religion. It is not a freedom from religion. It was meant to secure liberty, liberty of religion. And this non-establishment clause, therefore, was meant to promote religious liberties, not to restrict it. Let me say it again. The First Amendment is there to promote religious liberties. In fact, the main point of the first clause is not to prohibit the free exercise of religion, and that Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion is there to secure the liberty of exercising religion. So the whole point is freedom for religion. Now, some people seem to think that this clause was written to protect atheists. It wasn't. It was written to protect religious people. And if atheists don't like the consequences, like looking at crosses, too bad. That's the price of living in a pluralistic society with religious liberty, seems to me. Now, the present trend, though, is different. The present trend, my point in reading the Constitution at this point was to say, look, there's kind of an obvious point being made here. Does anybody see that? Why is the present trend changed? Because the present trend is toward hostility towards religion in the public square, not of freedom of religion in the public square as the founders intended. It's rather a freedom from religion, which is something the founders never imagined. It's a kind of a favoring of atheism over theism. Why is that? I mean, this cross was erected in 1954. Why wasn't it struck down then? That's 52 years ago. I mean, it sat there for 35 years before some atheist got bugged about it and thought he had a case. Well, I'll tell you why it wasn't struck down there, because nobody considered it a violation of the Constitution at that time. But why now? The reason is that there has been a change in mood. Okay? And so now we have the view that some things in the past that were not considered violations of the First Amendment are now considered violations of the First Amendment. The mood has shifted. Now the question is, why is it that when the mood changes, our liberties change? It seems the whole point of the Bill of Rights was to protect us from shifting moods, right? You got the Bill of Rights, it's secure, it tells us what liberties we have, and that's the protection for us. And moods change, so what? We're protected. We're covered. Well, there's an answer to that question. There's a reason why the meanings of words change when the mood changes. Meanings of words here being a change from non-establishment for the purpose of protecting religious liberties to the concept of separation of church and state, which is being used much of the time as a lever against religion. And the reason that this has been able to happen is because the Constitution is viewed as a living document. Now, what does that mean? It means that the words can change their meanings when the mood changes. Now, I want you to just make an observation here with me. If you have a Constitution that is meant to protect your liberties, and you don't change the words of the Constitution, that would be an amendment. That takes a vote. But rather, you keep the same words and change the meanings of those words under the guise of a living document, a philosophy of the Constitution. You have done the very same things in practical terms as amending the Constitution. Because ultimately, What matters are the meanings, not the words. Those words had certain meanings before, and the words are secured because the presumption was the meaning stayed the same, and so you don't change the words. Now you can change the meanings, so you don't need to change the words. Our founders made the Constitution difficult to amend for a very good reason. Two-thirds of the Senate had to approve a constitutional amendment, and when it kind of passed their muster, then it went to the states, and two-thirds of the states, had to ratify by popular vote. Why did they make it so hard? They wanted to be sure that if any essential liberties were changed, the greatest majority of the people, you and I, that is, not judges, were on board with it. And this is why the living Constitution view is so dangerous. It puts de facto amendment powers in the hands of five judges. Now some people say, oh, well, you think the Constitution is dead. I say, no, I don't think it's dead. I think it's alive with its original intent. It's that Constitution, the original Constitution, that protects us. The fact is, when it comes to the living Constitution view, the only thing alive there is the imagination of justices. Justices we cannot control. That's why justices are not allowed to amend the Constitution. Only the people can. I say all of this because now, with justices amending the Constitution by changing definitions, following the idea of living Constitution, that erodes the kinds of freedoms that were originally intended for us to have, in specific religious freedom that allows us the freedom to communicate the gospel. And to the degree that those freedoms are eroded, our enterprise is interfered with. Allowing religious expression on public land is not endorsement, ladies and gentlemen. It's religious freedom. And if it's not endorsement, it certainly isn't establishment. Therefore, it isn't a violation of the Bill of Rights. A neutrality doesn't mean driving every vestige of religion from the public square. Go inside the Beltway in Washington, D.C. Take a tour. You'll see the city is thick with religious symbols on government property. And they're old. And they're Christian. Why was this okay for almost 200 years? And then all of a sudden, people started scratching their heads saying, well, we don't like this. It's a violation of separation. It's because the meanings of the words changed, and when the meanings changed, then we're not protected. By the way, the landmark argument or the national symbol argument or the military memorial argument offered by the city of San Diego has merit, maybe, but it isn't my argument. There's much more at stake here than sacrificing landmarks. There is no separation of church and state in the Constitution. Let me repeat that. There is no separation of church and state in the Constitution. The constitutional language is non-establishment, not separation. And so when people ask me, don't you believe in separation of church and state? I say, no, I don't, and neither should you. Instead, I believe in the Bill of Rights, as originally written, not as redefined by five justices to take away liberties. 1-800-227-5278. I'm Greg Kokel. More to come here on Stand to Reason.
Hi, this is Hugh Hewitt. Want to make a difference for a Christianity worth thinking about? Stand to Reason can help you do just that. STR trains Christians just like you to be effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Stand to Reason relies on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting in your area and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You will learn how to deliver a message that is accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a manner that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting STR Radio today. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800-2-REASON. Or send your gift to 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. Again, 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. And thank you for listening.
We are ambassadors for Christ. That's what Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 5:20. An effective ambassador has three essential skills. First, an ambassador must have the basic knowledge necessary for his task. Second, this knowledge must be deployed in a skillful way. There's an element of wisdom, a tactical and artful diplomacy that makes his message persuasive. Third is character. His personal maturity and individual virtue will either make or break his message. Stand to Reason's mission is to help you develop the foundational skills in each one of these areas. In Essential Ambassador Skills, Greg Kokel will train you in all three of these areas to be an effective ambassador for Christ and to represent God's message of grace in a broken world. To order this unique message, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. 800-2-REASON or str.org to order Essential Ambassador Skills by Greg Kokel.
Greg Kokel back with you here at Stand to Reason. And looks like we got a pretty good bank of callers. If you want to get in, 1-800-227-5278 in the 714 area code, and there are lines open there, 754-4150. Let's go to Danny in Marina Del Rey, California. Hi, Danny. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Greg. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I hope you can give me a better response to probably two of the toughest questions I get asked when I dialogue with non-Christians and like. Let me just set up my question. Most people, when I speak with them, will acknowledge that the separation from God and hell makes sense for those who are guilty and who have committed sin.
Mm-hmm.
What they have trouble swallowing is why punishment that lasts forever and ever. You know, this doesn't seem at all commensurate with what the average non-Christian did on earth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you take a typical average teenager who dies in a car accident before they accept Christ and so on. That doesn't seem fair to punish that person or relegate that person to hell forever. And then the second part, challenge, kind of tag on to that, it doesn't seem fair or loving in light of the fact we're all born with that sin nature, starting behind eight ball, if you will. And according to the Reformed view, the only way we can be saved from hell is if God chooses us. We never had that ability to choose our way out of it. And these are kind of the two parts
get asked. Yeah, there's a lot going on there, and especially the way you characterize the statements at the second question. It shows there's some confusion in the thinking, and so let me start. Well, okay, I'll answer the hell question first as best as I'm able, and then I'll go into the issue of the reform question, because I think that this is oftentimes misunderstood, and I think there are some difficulties there, but it's not as hard as it is the way you just explained it.
Okay.
On the hell question, a couple of different thoughts. Some have argued that hell is – the duration of hell is legitimate because the rebellion of individuals continues on forever, and so God is continuously punishing the rebellion. Because they are not regenerate, and they are still in their rebellious state, even in hell, and therefore the duration matches the crime. It isn't like they kind of get rehabilitated and they're done with, because as each day goes on, if they're paying for yesterday's crime for a date with a day in hell, then they're committing more crimes today, so they have to pay for them tomorrow, and this goes on ad infinitum. Mm-hmm. Now, that may or may not be satisfying to you. It's not to me. I think it's a little bit moot, but I don't. That solves a problem that I'm not concerned with, because I'm satisfied with a different explanation. But if that
add something to that before you get on to the next.
Yeah,
it seemed like the rich man seemed remorseful in the Lazarus story.
Well, he might have been remorseful, but it doesn't mean that he was repentant.
True. But
I mean, he says, "I'm in misery down here." You know, please tell my
Well, what I meant by that is. You don't know for sure if he's repentant, but he seemed like, well, gee, there's a couple of other people like my brothers who would be willing to repent, and if he had a second chance, he himself would be willing to.
Right.
Because his brother, he seemed like there was a way out.
Right. That's a legitimate question. Like I said, I'm just tossing it out to you. Maybe it's apparently it's not compelling. And so here's the second answer. The question, I think the problem, part of confusion comes up with when we use the wrong concepts to assess a circumstance. You use the word fair a number of times. Fairness is not the issue. Justice is the issue. The question is whether it's just. It may be what you meant, but it's still, I wanted to specify. Justice has to do with appropriate punishment for crimes. Now, the question is, how could it possibly be appropriate for God to punish forever somebody who sinned a temporal amount of time? When we think about it, the duration of the punishment or the intensity of the punishment has nothing to do with the amount of time the crime took to commit. You can murder somebody in a matter of seconds, but the punishment is for a lifetime, or maybe you lose your life.
Right.
So there's, it's kind of a mistake to even look at it that way at all. Now, I agree that when we consider eternity with no possible end to it, and the crimes that we've committed here on Earth, that seems to be an imbalance here. Okay, I mean, I understand that, and that that objection resonates with me. But I have two observations about that. First of all, we are the ones that are the criminals deciding whether the punishment given to us is just or not. Mm-hmm. And I think probably it's reasonable if God is a holy God and a perfectly just God, then he is not going to make a mistake on this one, and that he is probably in a better position to judge what is just in terms of our crime than we are, because he sees our crime as it actually is, rather than us trying to assess it from the inside of our own guilt and culpability. And this brings me to my second point. I sometimes ask people, if they're parents, that if they would punish their child if he slapped their friend down the street, their buddy, and they said, yes, they shouldn't do that. Well, would you punish him if he slapped you? Well, yes. Would the punishment be the same? Well, the answer to that is always no. And the reason is, as parents understand, that it is a bigger crime for the child to slap his buddy than it is to slap his parent, because the parent have a different role vis-a-vis the child in their life. And so it is the nature of this role that changes the nature of the crime and therefore changes the nature of the punishment. Are you with me so far?
Yes.
Okay, in this particular case, the slap in the face is by a rebellious creature to the Creator. A refusal to live according to the Creator's desires, though there is every reason that the Creator has to expect the created to do so. And instead, there's rebellion, and so the Creator responds with complete banishment. Some have focused on hell mostly as banishment and not as punishment. You don't want God. God says, okay, you can't have me forever. So now you are banished. The problem with being banished away from the presence of God forever, which is in keeping with the person's initial desires, they don't want God on this earth, they don't want God on God's terms, and therefore God lets them go. He gives them what they want. The problem is they were made for God. And so that's their telos, that's their ultimate goal, that human nature is most fully and completely fulfilled through God and a relationship with Him. So when they are permanently banished from God's presence, which God is the ultimate fulfillment of their desires, and there is no grace available to that God from that God anymore, not even the prevenient grace that kind of goes out to everybody, the consequence is utter anguish. And that is a punishment. There is wailing and gnashing of teeth because there is a separation in eternal darkness from that which is the source of all joy and goodness. People are left to stew forever in the condition that they chose. And this is what this perfectly holy and just God considers appropriate given the nature of the rebellion. Now, I think when you look at it in those terms, it looks a little different. It isn't as if God is spanking us forever for a crime, just a little bitty thing that we did. No, he's offered us an eternity with him. We've spit in his face and utterly rebelled against him, and so God let us go. Remember in Romans it says he gave them over.
Right.
That means he removes the grace. Somebody told me once that there was a guy who was talking to him, and the guy was telling him how he hates God and he doesn't want anything to do with God. And so he was a kind of an atheist type, whatever, had a real attitude. So the guy said, okay, I'm going to pray for you right now. I'm going to pray that God removes all of his presence and his protections from you. And so he starts praying aggressively like that, and the guy says, hey, cut that out. It shook him up a little bit. And I don't know what was going on in the guy's mind, but I think there's a sense in which we realize that things are pretty good, better than they ought to be, because God has given us grace that we don't deserve, which I guess that's what grace is. He's given us help that we don't deserve, which is grace. And if God were to take all of his grace away, it would be a pretty nasty place. And that's exactly what we have in hell. So when people say, I don't want any of your grace, we don't always know entirely what it is we're saying, but he gives us what we're asking for. And that's banishment, and it's forever. There's no place anymore in his kingdom. In fact, C.S. Lewis argues, kind of implicitly in The Great Divorce, that they wouldn't be happy in heaven anyway, because they aren't made for it. That is, in their ruined condition. Remember when it says the eternal destruction for those in hell? That doesn't mean annihilation. It means ruin. That means they are never able to accomplish what they were made for. And this living in this ruined state is anguish. So, I mean, it's something to think about.
Right.
To some degree, to me that's a compelling explanation, especially when I say that helps me give some insight into God knows what he's doing.
Sure.
And I'd rather trust his assessments than mine, since I'm the guilty party. And we're always going to do ourselves a favor. Now, the second question, though, does that help up so far?
Yeah, that helps a lot. I guess, in your view, the banishment itself is a punishment.
Yes, it is.
That's the punishment, and that's the weeping and gnashing teeth. It's just that kind of eternal remorse that you experience.
Well, I'm not exactly sure. One could argue that it is just the banishment that is God's act of punishment, and that the anguish comes from being ruined in banishment. Now, I'm not entirely sure that all the anguish comes from that. J.P. Moreland seems to argue that way, but it may be that God is heaping pain on people as well. And if so, it's because they deserve it.
And that may be the degrees of punishment that people have for Hitler versus the, your average, you know, teenager or something like that.
Yeah, keep in mind that this is an act of justice, so there are crimes being paid for. And this is why I tend to say, in addition to that, God is bringing punishment on people commensurate with their crimes. And it's clear to me that some have greater judgments than others. That just makes sense from a reflection on justice. And it also has a biblical support in a number of places.
Now, I don't want to take away from that the second part, do you think that people will actually be doing things in hell, for example, working or?
No, I don't think there's anything meaningful going on.
They're just hanging out.
They're ruined.
And okay.
They're in a state of existence, in darkness, in blackness, in loneliness, in ruin, and in utter anguish and torment. It's not a pretty picture. You do not want to go there. Okay, now with that in mind, let's move to the next thing, and that has to do with, the implication, the way you put it was, it's kind of God's fault they go to hell anyway, because after all, if he didn't elect them, then they had no chance. And the implication is even if they wanted to, they couldn't do it. But the problem here is, and this is where I think the reform view has to be made clear, and my suspicion is, might be a little overstatement, but I think even a carefully articulated Arminian view would have to hold this too. And that is, people go to hell not because God didn't elect them in either sense of the term, whether it's an Arminian or Calvinist sense. They go to hell because God sent them where they belong, having violated his law. This is a judicial act based on their crimes. So it would not be fair or reasonable for a killer, a felon, a terrible criminal, to say, it's not fair for you to throw me in jail or even to execute me. Why? Because you didn't offer me a pardon. And see, if you had offered me a pardon, I wouldn't be here because I'd have taken it.
Right.
You'd have pardoned me. I wouldn't be here. And so because you didn't pardon me, this is the effective cause of my punishment. My response is malarkey. It's not the effect. You're the cause of your punishment. You brought this on yourself. Now, God could stay his hand if he chose to, but he's not obliged to do that. And in fact, even from the Christian perspective, when God stays his hand, it isn't because he didn't get his, because the punishment wasn't accomplished, but that there was a substitute, that God took the punishment on himself in the person of Jesus Christ. So even in that case, you know, God doesn't wink at the justice issue. Now, some might say, well, this isn't loving. Well, I don't know what's not loving about it. It's frustrating for me when I hear that come up, as if, why would this, first of all, why would this not be loving? And, or maybe a better question is, what does love have to do with it at all? Mm-hmm. Listen, if and I've given this illustration many times, and you can give this with somebody else. What if somebody came into your home and, raped your wife, hurt your children, and stole from you when you got back? You found out all this carnage was left in their wake, but they caught the guy. You think, oh, fantastic, now justice could be done. But then you find out that though he's guilty, he's released because the judge, having found him guilty, then says you can go free because we're a loving country. Mm-hmm. Now, what would you think of that?
Yeah.
Would you be satisfied with that? Now, I chose the personal thing, it happened to you, but I suspect if it happened to your neighbor or somebody you didn't even know, you'd still feel upset
right.
because your sense of justice is violated. This wasn't right. Mm-hmm. So if it's not right for the judge, why should it be right for God, for goodness sake?
Exactly. Yeah, I've actually given that analogy many times.
Yeah, so I think that's compelling. If people right. aren't satisfied by that, I don't know what to say to them after that.
Well, I think
what gives them the idea that God is a God of love?
I think, again, it's not necessarily the fact that that these people deserve punishment and so on. It's who gets elected. It seems fairly arbitrary. You know, even when you said, I think you used this analogy before. The governor chooses to what is it, give him early release from prison.
Yeah, or pardon or something like that. But let me bite the bullet and say, okay, it's arbitrary. I mean, I don't know that it is or not because I don't know God's mind, but let's say it is. Mm-hmm. You know, when Jesus gave the parable of the people that came into work, was it arbitrary for him to pay the guy who came in the morning one denarii and the guy who came in at noon one denarii and the same thing to the guy that came in at 4 o'clock? Was that arbitrary? Okay, maybe. So what? It's his money.
Yeah.
He can do with his stuff what he wants. So even if it were arbitrary, I don't know why that changes anything. We owe God. God doesn't owe us. If you owe me $1 million and Melinda owes me $1 million and I say, Danny, forget about it. But Melinda, she's still on the hook for the $1 million. Have I mistreated her? Can't I do with my own what I want? Which was Jesus' comment. It seems to me I can. So even if we say it is arbitrary, it's still within God's purview to do that. It's his own business. The only thing he can't do is he can't punish innocent people. That would be unjust. And I made a comment a moment ago, it got bypassed, but I mean, I might, for people who raise the love issue, and I'm going to have to move on after this comment, but for people who raise the love issue, I would ask the question, whatever gave you the idea that God was loving? Well, because the Bible says so. Yeah, you're right. It also says he's just. Mm-hmm. So, and the two aren't in conflict. They want to take God's love and make it be the all-encompassing principle, and then they want to define love in a sentimental way that satisfies their concerns, emotional sensitivities. They want to say, okay, he's love, and that's all he is. And what that means is he never hurts anybody. He never punishes anybody. He lets everybody go. That's not a God of love. Love does not rejoice in unrighteousness. It rejoices in the truth. And God is able to not count trespasses because he has justice accomplished through his son. Now, if people ignore that and continue to rebel against God, then that's their problem. It isn't that God hasn't been loving and not made provision in spite of their rebellion for a pardon. He has. So that's the best I can do right now, Danny. Mm-hmm. Got to run to break, and it's a tough issue, but I hope that lends a little bit of clarity to it. Okay, thanks so much. Yeah. Greg Kokel, more to come here on Stand to Reason. Don't go away.
I have a suggestion for you. Pick up the phone and dial 1-800-2-REASON. That's Stand to Reason's toll-free number. Ask us to send you solid ground, then leave your name and address. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. If you call us, we're going to send you our bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, free for a year. This is no ordinary newsletter. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ. In Solid Ground, Greg Kokel will help you deal with issues like abortion, evolution, cloning, homosexuality, doctor-assisted suicide, something timely so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador on key issues you will be challenged on. So call us right now at 1-800-2-REASON and ask for Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free. Or go to our website at str.org and ask for Solid Ground. While you're at it, you can download some of the over 300 free reports you'll also find there. That's 1-800-2-REASON and on the web, str.org.
The Apostle Paul knew well the effect on those who engaged in empty chatter as they spread the virus of false knowledge. They went astray. So while entrusting the treasure of truth to his disciple Timothy and encouraging him to entrust it to other faithful men, Paul also exhorted him to guard the treasure. Paul's word guard comes from the activity or office of a watchman whose job it is to protect those who are asleep from harm. It implies a deliberate, conscious act and demands discernment in knowing what it is that has been placed under our care. Guard the treasure was Paul's final message to Timothy before Paul's death. It reflected the heartbeat of his ministry. Stand to Reason has chosen it as our theme this year because it reflects the heartbeat of our ministry. Guard the treasure which has been entrusted to you. To learn more about Stand to Reason and how we are training Christian ambassadors to guard the treasure, visit us at www.str.org. Our website is full of unique and useful training materials to train you to be an effective ambassador for Christ. That's www.str.org.
Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason, Clear Thinking Christianity, ladies and gentlemen, contending for the Christian worldview. And by the way, sometimes that's not so easy because some aspects of the Christian worldview are difficult, like hell. And though I understand that there are ways to explain it and characterize it and try to make some sense of some of these challenges, like the last question that was raised, there are still ambiguities. And to some degree, we have to be comfortable with that. I am persuaded by the Christian worldview not because I've solved all of the problems related to it or that I'm utterly comfortable with everything I discover about it. It's just that I have good reason to believe the worldview as a whole is true. And having done that, having understood that, then it's a matter of a growth and learning to try to make sense of this of the particulars that seem a little strange, or at least don't resonate quite with us. And sometimes we can do a better job on that than others, and sometimes we just say, you know what, I don't know. And this is where, and here I'm qualifying this phrase very carefully, this is where we have to take it on faith. And what I mean by that is active trust. In other words, it's not a blind leap of faith, but rather, I'm going to just trust the Lord on this, is what I mean to be saying when I say that. I have good reason to believe the whole project is solid, stable, believable, reliable, true. But the particulars, sometimes I'm not so sure about this. I mean, I don't have a clear explanation that satisfies me, but this is where I'm going to trust the Lord in those things that I don't quite understand that maybe He knows better. I'm not making a jump without the background. I'm not just saying, well, take it on faith. No, I'm saying I got good reason to believe the whole project. And therefore, I have reason to trust for those things that I don't understand. And that's somewhat the view that I take, although it's how do the ancients put it? Faith seeking understanding. So I try to understand, but I take based on the authority of a reliable and just and loving God what He seems to be saying about those things. And so I do my best to pass it on to you and to seek as much understanding as I'm capable of doing in the moment. But if I can't completely explain it to my own satisfaction, it doesn't upend the apple cart, because the whole issue, the whole Christian project is not resting on that particular issue. Okay, back to the phone, and let's go to Puerto Rico. Felix, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hello, Greg. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, glad to do so again.
Yes, my question today is about the correspondence theory. Do you think the correspondence theory renders useless unless we have the right set of glasses or worldview in place?
Well, the correspondence view is a way of understanding what the word truth means. And I want to just – let me clarify this for a moment and come back to your question, because there's an ambiguity there for me in your question. But let me set this up a certain way, and maybe this will help direct your comments. The correspondence view of truth is a way of understanding what we mean when we use the word truth or some of its variants. If I tell my wife, you know, honey, I was at the studio this afternoon doing the radio show. She said, are you telling me the truth? Of course I'm telling you the truth. Why would I lie about that? When we're talking here about the word truth, we are implicitly using this correspondence sense. That is, my statement corresponds to or fits the way the world really is. I said I was there, and I was there, therefore my statement was true. Now, what we are not doing when we talk about the correspondence theory of truth, I don't even think that's the right way of putting it. It's not a theory. What correspondence is a way of articulating what people mean when they use the word. And so this is inductive. We listen to our language, and we see how people use this. It's like I said, table. You know, if you didn't know what the word table was, and I started using the word table, you would see what it was referring to. And after a while, you'd pick up that this word table means one of these things, okay? And so you'd make the connection. You'd realize that my word is referring. That it wouldn't be this wouldn't be the round, hard, horizontal kind of thing with four legs theory of tables. You'd realize that the word table refers to these things, and so, you know, table means this, okay? And by and large, the garden variety usage definition of the word truth is what we have come to call the correspondence view of truth, or the correspondence definition. We have to distinguish it now in part because there is a controversy as to whether philosophically now we can know the world as it really is. We can know whether or not our statements about the world match up with the way the world is. If we can't, then even though we mean truth as correspondence when we use the word truth, we are not accomplishing truth as correspondence because we have no clear connection with the world as it is to see if our claims about the world match up with the world. So I could say, gee, I was at the studio. It's true, I was at the studio. And someone could say, how do you know where you were at? You may be a butterfly dreaming. How do you know what the world's really like? Maybe you're a Martian somewhere on another planet and you're having an illusion. So you can't claim that your statement is true. And see, this is where the controversy comes up about the definition. There are other kinds of ways that we use the word true, like we could say, well, it's true in a practical or pragmatic sense, that it works. You know, this is, how could I put it? I'm trying to think of some example of this, but I do things a certain way, and I could say, well, these work for me, so that's all the truth I need about the circumstance. You know, it works, so that's true. It's a pragmatic definition. We could say it's true in the sense that it coheres together, not that it fits the world, but it all kind of fits in a system together. That would be the coherence view of truth. But normally, when people are using the word, they're using it in the correspondent sense. So I have no temptation to abandon the correspondence sense just because somebody tells me I can't know the way the world really is, and therefore I can't make statements or beliefs match up with the world. If you deny correspondence, you're in a heap of trouble. If you say, oh, that's just a theory, but that's not the way it really is, then I'm going to ask a question. I said, really, that's not the true definition, is it? No, what is the true definition? And they're going to give me the true definition of truth. And what are they going to do then when they give me the true definition of truth? They're going to give me the true definition in a way that corresponds with the way the world really is.
So the correspondence stands on its own independently of the worldview that the person holds? Well,
I guess what I'm saying is if you deny the correspondence, that truth is correspondence, you're going to have to come up with some other word that means the same thing as truth is correspondence because that's the way you end up using the word anyway. Basically, you're going to say it's not true that truth is correspondence. It's true that truth is something else. And what do you mean by the word true there when you say it's not true, it is true? You're using it in the correspondent sense. So you're going to have to – you know what I'm saying? You can't avoid that. Now, you could try, but you ended up in confusion. And this is what the postmoderns do. They say there is no way the world really is, so you can't know the truth about the world. And by the way, that's the truth, correspondent sense, about the world.
So if I'm asked as a Christian, I'm asked, what do you mean when you say the world, the correspondence mean?
I mean the same thing that you mean.
The world is. What does the word world would mean in a Christian sense?
Okay, no, okay, that this is, you're making it harder than it is. What I mean, if somebody asked me that kind of question, I'd say, look, what I mean is, when I say it's true that God exists, I mean he does. When I say it's true that Jesus rose from the dead, I mean he did. That is, if you're standing at the gravestone, I mean at the grave 2,000 years ago on a certain Sunday morning, bam, a big boulder would have been blown by your head. It's true that he died in a Roman cross. If you were at that particular point of geography at that particular time in history and you leaned on the cross, you would have gotten a splinter. It was that real. I mean that it's a fact that these things happen, that the blood flowing down from that cross would have had a blood type. These are real things. My claim is that these are facts. The word truth and fact, same thing. And so, no, I could be mistaken about my facts, but I shouldn't be mistaken about the kind of facts I'm talking about. I'm talking about real facts.
Okay.
So if I say that God exists, I actually think that he does. I think that that's true. That I mean that it is so. I don't know how many other ways I can say this. It's just, it's very normal, ordinary, straightforward.
So basically, we would start by using ostensive definition or pointing at some particular thing and then start from there?
The roots of it are ostensive. That is that we're using the word truth to describe a relationship out there. How is the language being used? It's used to describe something out there. We are pointing, ostensive, pointing at this thing. We're saying, I believe that that is the case. And if it is the case, then it matches up with my belief and therefore the statement is true. You know, people want to monkey with this definition as if it's just something invented. It isn't something. It's something people use. It's a sound, a token that they use to describe a real, genuine relationship. As long as you have beliefs, then and the world, you're going to have the truth relationship. You know, I don't know. This isn't that hard. People are making playing all these games. The reason that they're playing all these games is they don't want people to have the right to claim that certain things are true, that are politically incorrect, like religion and morality. It's crazy. I don't know if that helps.
So the worldview, where you put it, and for the correspondence to make. I mean, does the worldview has a bearing on the correspondence theory?
What I'm saying is, you cannot avoid the correspondence view of truth, and every worldview, even the postmodern one, presumes it in its discussion. They all presume it. They presume that whatever claims they are making are actually so, that they fit the way the world is, whether it's a Hindu or a Buddhist or a Christian or a Muslim or a postmodernist or an atheist or anybody, whenever they make claims.
So you think that's at the heart of why the Constitution is interpreted or the Bible interpreted in different ways?
Well, the interpretation of the Bible and the Constitution is a whole different issue.
Yeah, sure.
It doesn't depend on this. It's apples and oranges at this point. It has to do with what you decide the words end up meaning. And so if you want to change the meanings of the words, if you want to change non-establishment in the First Amendment to separation of church and state, now you've amended the Constitution, so you've given a different meaning than the original meaning. That's an amendment, and it should go through the amendment process. That was kind of my point early on. Okay, Felix.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Craig, for taking my call.
Yeah, you're welcome. It's good talking to you. I appreciate that. I don't know what that means. By the way, you can go to our website. J.P. Moreland has written a paper that deals with this issue of truth and correspondence for anybody, not only Felix. And it's a paper he gave 2 years ago at the Evangelical Theological Society. So just go to our website at str.org and type in Moreland, M-O-R-E-L-A-N, and you'll probably find M-O-R-E-L-A-N-D, and you'll probably find it. It's absolutely superb paper, but it is a little philosophical, so it may take a little work, but it's worth it. That's what it is. We have one more minute to go. Is that what your point was? Yeah, right. Okay. What JP has done is he's taken a difficult philosophical issue and one that some people have not handled carefully, and he's handled it very, very carefully. And what he's done in this paper as he's really fired a broadside at so-called Christian postmodernists, those Christians who are even in the audience at the ETS conference that day, who are toying with the philosophy of postmodernism, and he talked about how deleterious, damaging it was to the Christian religion. So check that out, str.org, and type in Moreland and see if you get that ETS paper on truth and knowledge. 1 hour ahead of us here at Stand to Reason. Stay with us. I'm Greg Kokel. Where'd you get that rooster? That's not the normal one. He's not feeling well today. Greg Kokel back with you here, hour number two on Stand to Reason. Lines are full up. I'll be getting to your calls in just a moment. Wanted to congratulate our Frapper winners, Mark Hunsacker and Nixon, Missouri. That was 2 weeks ago. 1 week ago, Christopher Busby in Victoria, B.C. And this week, Carlos Gonzalez in Imperial, California. Congratulations to all of you. You have been chosen. And we'll be sending you our free gift, as we usually do. What is Frapper? Frapper's a map. If you go to our website at str.org and then click podcast, you can indicate on this Frapper map that you're one of our listening audience, especially for those who are outside of our footprint and want to put a pin in the map and say, hey, I'm over here in Puerto Rico or in Nixon, Missouri, or Victoria, British Columbia. I was there a week ago today. And we listen, and we like your show, and you can put a little information about yourself. And then from that grouping, we draw names and send a free gift to. So check that out. And congratulations to Mark Hunsacker, Christopher Busby, and Carlos Gonzalez. The Supreme Court in the state of New York, or make that the New York Court of Appeals, which is the state's highest court, has struck down an appeal regarding same-sex marriage in the state of New York, which is quite a stunner when you think about it. Wait a minute. Are you telling me a judge in the appellate court in New York struck down same-sex marriage? Yeah, and he did so for a good reason. I mean, this has set back the same-sex marriage cause considerably, which I'm glad to hear. Especially when I consider the rationale that's been offered. Now, before I get to the judge's comments, and I'll read it for you directly, I want to remind you of how Stand to Reason has argued consistently on this issue. And if you want more detail about that, you can go to our website at str.org, and you could type in same-sex marriage. You can't type in homosexual marriage because that's the wrong term. Homosexuals can already be married. They just can't be married to each other. There's no restrictions on homosexuals being married. There is restrictions on same-sex marriage. Our solid ground, September-October 2004, an entire argument, I should say an entire article, giving rational arguments against same-sex marriage, and I never quote the Bible once. I never make moral complaints. No moral judgments against homosexuality. I approach this issue as a policy issue. In other words, when it comes to same-sex marriage, I ask the question, why should government get involved in regulating these private relationships? You see, I agree with people, by and large, who say the government shouldn't be telling us what we should be doing in our own bedrooms. You know, consenting adults in the privacy of their own homes. Fine, I'm with you on that. But this isn't about what consenting adults do in the privacy of their own bedrooms. This is about what the government affirms publicly. This is about regulating relationships. You know, marriage licenses not only give a license and give license to, but impose regulations. Married people have regulations both in favor and against that non-married people don't have. So the government intrudes in a relationship. Why? There's a reason for it. In fact, I've asked the question frequently in my arguments on this issue, why has every government Every nation, every culture, in every period of history from the dawn of time until now, given preferences, given privileges, given protections, and proscriptions, that's limitations, prohibitions, restrictions, to long-term committed monogamous heterosexual unions. Why? And this is a policy question. Why do governments do that regarding their people? And the reason is very simple. Long-term committed monogamous heterosexual unions, as a rule, as a group, and by nature, and by design, I might add, produce the next generation. Same-sex relationships, or any other heterosexual relationships for that matter, do not, as a rule, as a group, and by nature, produce the next generation. Well, the government doesn't care about your sexual tastes. What they care about, they don't care about who you sleep with. They don't care about what you do behind closed doors. They care about children. And so if your relationship characteristically produces children, they want to protect those children. And therefore, they regulate and license and privilege the particular kinds of union that produce those children characteristically. Some people don't. So what? If you get married, you don't have kids, that's not the government's concern. That's your concern. But since characteristically these unions produce children, then they regulate the unions to protect the children. That's the rational basis for government involvement in marriage, which rational basis does not apply to same-sex marriages. Therefore, the government has no rational basis for getting involved in it. That's been our argument from the outset, insofar as we've argued same-sex marriage on a policy basis. And I suspect and suggest it should be yours as well. Because going to them beating people over the head with the Bible and a bunch of verses from Leviticus, or Romans 1 for that matter, isn't going to help. The issue isn't about the morality of homosexuality. The issue is a policy question of what we as a people want to affirm and regulate and control. And we have every right and reason not to affirm same-sex relationships as the same as heterosexual relationships. And there is no rational justification for the government to get involved in regulating and giving preference for that, because the preference that is given to heterosexual relationships are for very good reason. Now, with that in mind, that's our argument. And here now, New York State's highest court offers what Mona Charon calls a new argument against a right to gay marriage. It's not a new argument, it's our argument. Here I'm quoting from the justice. First, the legislature could rationally decide that for the welfare of children, it is more important to promote stability and to avoid instability in opposite sex than in same-sex relationships. Heterosexual intercourse has a natural tendency to lead to the birth of children. Homosexual intercourse does not. Despite the advances of science, by the way, I don't know what science can do about this. Science will never be able to make fertile homosexual intercourse. Anyway, it doesn't mean homosexuals can't have kids, but not through intercourse. Despite the advances of science, he continues, it remains true that the vast majority of children are born as a result of sexual relationship between a man and a woman. The vast majority, like every single one of them, even though the sexual relationship might be a tad removed in vitro. In any event, and the legislature could find that this will continue to be true. This is not rocket science. The legislature could also find that such relationships are all too often casual or temporary. It could find that an important function of marriage is to create more stability and permanence in the relationships that cause children to be born. It thus could choose to offer an inducement in the form of marriage and its attendant benefits to opposite-sex couples who make a solemn long-term commitment to each other. Now that is smart legislating. The judge is saying, look, the legislature could do this for all good reasons. Now, of course, there were dissenters. Judge Kaye argued that the historic and cultural understanding of marriage did not justify discrimination. The historical and cultural understanding of marriage did not justify discrimination. Oh? Really? Ladies and gentlemen, do you realize that every law discriminates in some way? You know, there's a law that allows us to have a driver's license. But if you're 14, you can't have one. Horrors. Discrimination. Yes, it's discrimination. Of course it's discrimination. And it's discrimination with a rational basis. Well, to paraphrase Judge K, the historic and cultural understanding of driver's license did not justify discrimination. Of course it does. That's the reason for it. Quoting here, simply put, a history and tradition of discrimination, no matter how entrenched, does not make discrimination constitutional. As history has well taught us, separate is inherently unequal. Well, now she's drawing from racial things. It's apples and oranges, Judge K. I don't know why everybody else can see that and you can't. In any event, the critical issue here is not religion. It is not immorality. It is not even discrimination. The question is whether there's a rational basis for the law as written. And there is. And therefore, we are within our rights to stand by marriage as a license from the government promoting heterosexual unions and not same-sex unions. I got to go to a break, but I'm Greg Kokel, and I'll be back to your calls in just a moment. This is Stand to Reason.
Hi, this is Hugh Hewitt. Want to make a difference for a Christianity worth thinking about? Stand to Reason can help you do just that. STR trains Christians just like you to be effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Stand to Reason relies on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting in your area and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You will learn how to deliver a message that is accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a manner that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting STR Radio today. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800-2-REASON. Or send your gift to 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. Again, 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. And thank you for listening.
We are ambassadors for Christ. That's what Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 5:20. An effective ambassador has three essential skills. First, an ambassador must have the basic knowledge necessary for his task. Second, this knowledge must be deployed in a skillful way. There's an element of wisdom, a tactical and artful diplomacy that makes his message persuasive. Third is character. His personal maturity and individual virtue will either make or break his message. Stand to Reason's mission is to help you develop the foundational skills in each one of these areas. In Essential Ambassador Skills, Greg Kokel will train you in all three of these areas to be an effective ambassador for Christ and to represent God's message of grace in a broken world. To order this unique message, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. 800-2-REASON or str.org to order Essential Ambassador Skills by Greg Kokel.
Greg Kokel back at you here at Stand to Reason. Careful, intelligent discussion about ethics, values, and religion. I'm giving you a piece of my mind today as you are to me. And let's continue that process. Go right to the phones here. And let's see. San Jacinto and John. Thank you for calling, John.
Yeah, hi, Greg.
Hi.
Some time ago, you said on your show that the Virgin Mother had mixed feelings about Christ in his early religious preaching. In fact, I seem to recall I read in one of the Gospels that she thought he was mad.
Okay.
Are there any biblical citations you could offer?
Sure. You know, the irony of this, and I was thinking about...
And I bring this up in the context of being an ex-Catholic, where they put almost as much emphasis on the Virgin.
Right.
And you were saying it in that topic.
Well, you said you think you remember reading something in the Gospels. I did this morning, in fact. It's so ironic. I was going through the text, I don't get to read every day. I mean, I know I'm supposed to, but it just doesn't always happen, to be honest with you. And I was thinking, you know, it seems like when I do sit down and I study and I attend to the text, that boy, within, you know, sometime later that day, I'm able to draw from that and make application. And here it is. I was in Mark chapter 3 this morning, first couple chapters of Mark, actually, chapter 3 and verse 21. This is early on, fairly early in Jesus' ministry, okay? And it says in verse 21, and when his own people heard of this, let me back up just for a minute. He chose the 12, all right, so he's already got his 12. He'd been preaching for a while, and he draws his disciples. Then he chooses the 12 who would follow him from that group that had been following the larger group. Verse 20 of chapter 3, it says, and he came home, which actually into a house. The multitude gathered again to such an extent that they couldn't even eat a meal. So he's got a massive following, all right? He can't even eat. Next verse, 21, and when his own people heard of this, they went out to take custody of him, for they were saying he has lost his senses. Now, it has a little parenthetical of about seven verses where it talks about the scribes saying he casts out demon by the ruler of demons, and Jesus responds to that. But there in verse 31, it picks up again, and his mother and his brothers arrived, and standing outside, they sent word to him and called him. And he doesn't listen, of course. He says, you're my mother, brother, and, you know, sisters. You know, whoever does the will of God, he's my brother, sister, and mother. So it's kind of a cryptic way Jesus answered. But to your point, it says here in this text that his own people thought he was nuts, and then they go to get him, which includes his mom. So, I mean, what do you make of that?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah. So, now, look, she was a good woman. She was confused about some things, no question, and this is obvious, and it's understandable. A lot of people were confused. In fact, the disciples who spent the most time with him were confused even after the resurrection. Mm-hmm. We see this in Acts chapter 1, in conversation that was going on there. There were things they didn't get. So I don't think this is an opportunity to think ill of her, but it's just to show that, you know, Jesus was an enigmatic figure. He was an iconoclast. He didn't stick with the images or the standards that people expected of him as an individual or as the Messiah, as they come to see him as the Messiah. And even his own family was scratching his head. By the way, you know, there were two members of his family that we know, in addition to his mother, who we implicitly we think became a follower, obviously, but explicitly we know that James and that's the author of the book of James and Jude were Jesus' half brothers that were his after he was born. Then his mother Mary had children. I don't think she was ever virgin.
The Catholic Church does not. They simply claim that they were spiritual brothers.
There's no reason whatsoever.
The way that Abraham called Lot his brother.
I understand. I understand that people could say that about, it's possible to use the term that way, but it doesn't mean that every time the word is used that way, that's what it means. There is no textual evidence that Mary was ever a virgin. None. Absolutely none. And in fact, the most natural way to take all of these things is that these were the offspring of Mary and his natural brothers and sisters, though half-brothers and sisters, literally, or as a matter of fact.
Yeah, on the virgin point, I have read that the Hebrew that the Catholic Church claims says she was a virgin really means young woman.
Yeah, but even if she was a young woman, that's Alma, when she became pregnant, it didn't mean that she was forever a virgin. It just, I mean, it doesn't mean that. This is part of their tradition that they're trying to read back into the text. Look, when in Matthew 4 and Luke 4, parallel accounts, Jesus comes into his town. He speaks at the synagogue there, and they're saying, who is this guy? I mean, you know, we know his brothers and sisters and his family. Now, if they meant brothers and sisters in the sense that you just described, this statement doesn't make any sense. Where did he get this great learning? This is the guy who grew up down the street. We know his family is what they're saying. All of a sudden, he's a big shot. And they were actually marveling at that point. Now, a little later, they got mad at him and almost killed him. But at that point, they were marveling. They were all speaking well of him. But notice how they put it. We know his family, his brothers. And they got the names of his brothers and sisters in there. So, and the distinction of James, if he's called the brother of the Lord, why isn't Paul the brother of the Lord? Why isn't John the brother of the Lord? Why aren't all of these disciples called the brother of the Lord? None of them are called that, though they might have been by that definition of brother. No, it's probably because James was the brother of the Lord, the brother, the actual Athophos, you know, the brother.
Yeah.
Not the cousin, not the buddy, not the, you know, kindred spirit. So there's no reason to take that except for Roman Catholic dogmatism, and it's not justified. I think it puts Mary in a position that she ought not be, and I suspect you share that opinion.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Good talking to you, John. I appreciate the call. Let's go to Rodney. Rodney, welcome to Stand to Reason. Rodney from New Zealand.
Yeah, hi, Greg.
Hey, how are you doing, mate?
Good, thanks, good. Before I ask my question, just wanted to give a plug for the MP3 files that you've made available for sale on the website.
Uh-huh. Well, I thought about...
Because it's obviously shipping costs for those of us on the other side of the world can be a bit of a hindrance to purchasing your material.
Sure, of course.
It makes it real easy for us.
Yes, well, I'm so glad to hear that. I thought of you Kiwis when we put that up. We've been wanting to do it for a long time. It's been about a year and a half since I've been in New Zealand. And even when I was there then, I said, you know, it's coming, so hang in there. And so we're thrilled to be able to offer our products, and virtually all of our products now. The vast majority of the most popular products are available on MP3, and the notes you can download a PDF file, so it doesn't matter where in the world you are. If you can do internet commerce with a credit card or something, you can get our stuff instantly, essentially. And I'm glad that you brought this up, Rodney, because I wanted to encourage a lot of listeners that may not have realized that they can get this wherever they happen to be. Even if you can get shipping in the United States, look, you can still save money on the product and on the shipping and get it instantly by downloading it to your own medium. So we want to underscore this for everyone listening, and particularly those who are outside of the country, that virtually everything that is popular on our website and training material can now be purchased and downloaded virtual at great savings and at great speed.
Yeah,
I'm glad you're using it, Rodney.
Now, my question, there are three terms, postmodernism, relativism, and religious pluralism.
Right.
Now, I understand very roughly religious pluralism is a sort of a subset of relativism, and relativism is a sort of a subset of postmodernism.
Right.
But I wondered if you could discuss the key differences between these.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. Let's start with relativism, all right? All forms of relativism have something in common, and that has to do with what makes a claim true, the truth maker, all right? Now, this goes back to an earlier discussion that I've had with callers on what definition of truth is the appropriate definition. Classically, and this goes back to Aristotle in terms of the characterization, but he only offers this characterization because it was consistent with the way people used the word truth then and now. Classically, the correspondence understanding of the word truth is what has been in play. So the way Aristotle's put it, he said, if you say that it is and it is, or if you say that it isn't and it isn't, then your statement is true. Now, that's pretty straightforward, okay? In other words, if truth is the matching up of a belief or a statement and the way the world really is, if you say that it is and it is, then the thing that makes any statement true would be some feature in the world. Okay, so if I say my pen is on my Bible, you can't see it, but it happens to be there, and it is. Then my statement's true, but it's only true because of some feature in the world that makes it true. The thing that makes it true is some object in the world. All right? You with me so far?
Yeah, there's a relationship between your statement and the actual reality.
Very straightforward, okay? Now, relativism changes that equation. In relativism, the truth maker is not the object in the world. The truth maker is the subject. It is the person. So on a relativistic point of view, if I said, is it true that the pen is on my Bible? The answer is, yes, it is true if I think it is. Notice how it's reflexive. It's almost like the statement goes out for me and then comes back to me. It's true if I think it is. Then it's true for me. So the truth maker is some subjective state or belief in the person. Just believing it, just holding it so, makes it so on this way of viewing truth. That's a relativistic view. Are you with me?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, now that's as precise of a definition as I could come up with. So how this applies in other circumstances is if I say that homosexuality is wrong, is it wrong? From the objective perspective, it's only wrong if, as an objective state of affairs, there is some absolute or objective moral principle that says it's wrong. But on the relativistic view, it's only wrong if I think it is. So it's wrong for me. If you think it's right, then it's true for you. And therefore, moral relativism is moral truths are all dependent on the beliefs of the subject, the individual who holds them. It has nothing to do with the way the world is. Okay. Religious relativism is called pluralism. Okay. Now, there's two ways to characterize pluralism. I mean, I presume you, when you said pluralism, you meant religious pluralism, but maybe you didn't mean that.
No, I did. Yes.
Oh, you did or didn't?
I did. Religious pluralism.
Okay, yeah.
As a subset of relativism.
Right. Pluralism could mean, it could simply be an observation. Well, there are different points of view. Okay, that's one way of looking at it. That's called soft pluralism. Hard pluralism is more directed. It's saying that all the points of view are basically as good as any other. All right?
Yeah.
Now, so no one religion is any better than any other in terms of it accomplishing its goal. Now, that could be understood in an objectivist sense or a subjectivist sense. Okay, in an objectivist sense, somebody like John Hick would argue, well, all religions in fact lead to God. And he gives his reasons why, that no religion is any better in getting you to God as a matter of fact. Okay, a relativist would argue that no religion gets you anywhere, as far as we know. All we have is our own beliefs. And people's beliefs are true for themselves. So your religion is true for you. My religion is true for me. Notice in the second case, we're not making any statements about the way the world is. We're just talking about our beliefs. Mm-hmm. So pluralism can be secured either in a relativistic sense or in an objectivistic sense. They all kind of claim in a certain sense that all religions are equal, but they mean something different. One says that God is happy with any of them and you can get to God through any of them, the objectivist sense. And the other is a relativistic sense that basically says we don't know anything about any truths about religion, but you have your beliefs and that's fine, that's true for you. All right?
Okay, yeah.
Now, what is postmodernism? Well, it's a lot of things. It's a reaction against modernism, but for our purposes, that is how this ties in with the truth issue, which is what we're talking about. Postmodernism entails the denial that we can know the world as it really is. Now, there are different ways that's characterized, but the standard way it's characterized, when you want to refine it and get down to what's going on here philosophically, is that the only world that we have contact with is a world that's constructed by our linguistic group. Okay, so we think we're in touch with the world, but really we're just in touch with the kind of world our language has made for us. And if you and I are in the same linguistic community, well, then we have the same world that we've constructed because we share the same story. But really, it's a constructed world. We don't know what the world out there is really like. Now, if you don't know what the world, as it is in itself, is really like, well, then there can't be any statements that match up with that world that you can know about. You can't say, okay, the pen is on the book in the real world because you can't get at the real world. The only world you're at is your linguistically constructed world. And so all you can say is, in my narrative, this happens. But you know, you're talking about not the world, but your subject, the subject, your community or whatever. So it's a kind of, I think it's a kind of relativism, and I would defend that in that sense. Now, in that sense, when it comes to knowledge, knowledge is reflexive. Truth statements are go back to the community that state them. They are true because the community says they are. And it's not because they match up with the real world, because if you're postmodern, you don't believe you can get out there. You're stuck inside language. There's no difference between language and the world that you know. So these terms have they have kinship to each other, but there are some distinctions.
Right.
So you can be a relativist about certain things and not be a postmodernist. If you're you could be a relativist, you could be a modernist, you could believe in truths, but you don't believe that there are moral truths. You just think that everybody's moral truth is for themselves. So you could be a moral relativist and an atheist, and in the modernist cast. And you could also be a pluralist in the modernist cast. A pluralist of a certain, actually a pluralist of both sorts, it seems to me. Now, if you're a postmodernist, I think you are stuck with both relativism and knowledge and pluralism, therefore. If you're a postmodernist.
Okay.
Because postmodernism seems to, at its core, be at least minimally a statement or a view about knowledge and truth. And it turns out to be a denial of knowledge and truth, at least in the way we have understood it in the past, that is, in a correspondence relationship. That makes sense, Rodney?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, that was great.
Thank you.
Okay, I appreciate it.
Fun for me, too. Okay, Rodney, we'll hear you next time.
Okay.
Okay, stay in touch. Bye-bye now.
Okay, thanks.
All the best to you. Bye-bye. It's always good to hear from New Zealand. I like them. I like the Kiwis. Okay, and now to Columbia, New Jersey. Let me find that. Make that Missouri. Let me find the button. Paul in Columbia, welcome to Stand to Reason. Hi.
Hi, Greg. Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
I want to follow up quickly on that Roman Catholic call, call about Mary. I just finished a wonderful book by Dr. Eric Svensson, Who is My Mother. He was interviewed by the Bible Answer Man when the book first came out.
Oh, no kidding. That's right from the verse we were talking about in Mark chapter 3.
Exactly. He addresses everything you mentioned biblically. It was his doctoral dissertation, and he debated a leading Roman Catholic apologist on this. A few years back and just demolished him.
Yeah, well, I don't – so did he hold the view that I suggested just then?
Yeah, in fact, one of the key passages was the term heos hu, which is Greek for until, and he demonstrated something historical in the theological world, that every time – and I won't get into the details, it's all in the book – that when that kept her a virgin until, that deliberately means – until a certain point, and there may have been a change afterward.
Yeah.
Whereas the Catholics say, no, she was perpetual virgin.
Yeah.
It's dogmatically declared, and you have to believe it.
Yeah, well, it's dogmatically declared by the Roman Catholic Church, but there's not a shred of textual evidence for such a thing and much against it. So I don't even know what the big deal is. I mean, I can understand, for people who are raised in that environment and this is just what they've been taught, I can understand how this is somehow a precious truth to them. So subjectively, I understand that if you're reared in that, how you hang on to that. I'm not taking exception with that. I'm saying, why is this worth fighting for theologically? What is the point? And
why is it part of the gospel?
Pardon me?
They consider it part of the gospel.
Well, I don't know how the gospel is compromised if Mary has other children.
Exactly. It's crazy.
Even from a Roman Catholic perspective, I don't know what could possibly influence that. Anyway, that's a different issue, but thanks for the update on that.
Okay.
I'm glad to know there are other people in my corner on that one. Although, like I said, this to me is not a jump ball or anything close to that. There is no evidence for the other view, and there's total evidence for this for the Protestant view on this one. So,
yeah, well, I highly recommend that book.
Good. What was the title again?
Who is My Mother?
Who is My Mother? Okay.
By Dr. Eric Svensson, Svendsen.
Okay.
He has an outfit called NTR Ministry.
Okay, great. So,
in fact, his debate is available at I think it's StraightGate. com.
Okay.
Like STRAIT, like the old King James.
Oh, okay.
Straight is the way.
Yeah, okay.
The audio is there, too. It's a fantastic debate.
Okay, good. Paul, what's your question?
Oh, I'm sorry. I wanted your perspective on something. There's an upcoming debate at Liberty University between Dr. Ergen Kanner and Dr. James White.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to get your perspective on the thesis. It says, resolved that God is an omnibenevolent God to all of humanity through salvation and opportunity. I want to get your perspective. Does that
if he would have stopped and said God is an omnibenevolent God, mm-hmm. I would have agreed, which means that all the goodness that there is, God possesses. Now, the resolve seems to include more things. He is omnibenevolent. Well, look at, I don't know, what's the second half? He's omnibenevolent what?
Okay, I'll do it all again. That God is an omnibenevolent God to all of humanity through salvation and opportunity.
Okay. There is a sense in which I could agree with that, even as put, because I would say that God's goodness is complete in all areas of his working, through salvation and through opportunity. There is no compromise of God's goodness on any of those things. Here is my suspicion, given who's in the debate. Now, I don't know the first man, but Dr. James White, I do know, and I know James is a Reformed thinker. And so this is probably an Arminian-Calvinist debate. And the Arminian wants to couch this debate in terms of God's omnibenevolence. And therefore, if Calvinism is on the Calvinistic view, God is not omnibenevolent. He's only omnibenevolent on the Arminian view, which I disagree with. I think it is true that God is omnibenevolent, and he is omnibenevolent in the areas that were just described. In fact, if you're omnibenevolent, any area you describe, you're going to be benevolent in. But it doesn't cash out on the Arminian side of the equation, because I don't think that the goodness of God requires that God not be the elector of those who are saved. In fact, if I understand my theology properly, it is because of God's goodness that he elects anybody. I mean, it's an act of goodness and mercy that is above and beyond the call, as it were. Actually, that's a pun, but I didn't intend it. It's called a supererogatory act. That is, goodness does not require that God forgive anybody. It does not require that. But God went above and beyond what goodness required, and he forgave some as an act of sovereign mercy. So election is an act of God's sovereignty. But is an act of God's goodness. But some Arminians want to cast this as somehow a mean thing that God is doing, that he's not calling everybody. And that only way God could be good is if he evens the playing field and makes it is and maybe by their perspective plays no favorites. God is not obliged not to play favorites in this. And I explained in an earlier call the parable that Jesus offered, which I think is perfect for this circumstance. You know, Paul?
Yeah.
He said, look, can't I do with what I want with what is mine? Why is that any different in this circumstance? So I think that, you know, I'm sure that James White is on to this, but the resolve is loaded. In any debate, by the way, and if you've had old school debating, you know that, it's the responsibility of one side to define the terms, and the other side can accept or reject, and that can be part of the debate. And I know how he's going to want to define these terms. He's going to want to define omnibenevolence, the one who's opposing Dr. White, as Arminianism.
Yeah, he refuses to accept that term. But I first discovered this term used by Dr. Geisler in his book, Chosen But Free.
What, omnibenevolence?
Omnibenevolence, yeah, that God is not discriminatory in his love. And actually, the participant, Ergen Kanner, did a sermon recently where he actually read from Romans 9 and said that God chose Jacob over Esau because of something he did.
Well, unbelievable.
9/11, he completely twisted it.
Well, keep in mind the word love, too, is it doesn't mean just one thing. God has a love for all of his creation.
Sure.
The cosmos. For God so loved the cosmos. That's the world system that he built. He also loves individuals. Now, he doesn't love the mountains the same way he loves people, it seems to me. And and it says in John 14 or 15, the Upper Room Discourse, I'm going to have to run out after this because we're at a break. I'm getting my hard signal here. That you know, if – I can't remember exact words, but it says something about if we follow him and walk with him, then he will love he will love us and make his abode with us. You know, so there's an additional kind of love. I think God's elective love is an additional level of love. And it's not all one thing, all to everybody equally. It's clear in Scripture that that's not the case. So I don't know why anybody would want to argue that way, especially the august Mr. Geisler, who's a friend, you know, but I don't agree with him on this point.
Sure.
Got to go.
Thanks, Greg.
Okay, good talking to you, Paul, in Columbus, and we'll be in Bristol, Connecticut. White, when I return here on Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
I have a suggestion for you. Pick up the phone and dial 1-800-2-REASON. That's Stand to Reason's toll-free number. Ask us to send you solid ground, then leave your name and address. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. If you call us, we're going to send you our bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, free for a year. This is no ordinary newsletter. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ. In Solid Ground, Greg Kochel will help you deal with issues like abortion, evolution, cloning, homosexuality, doctor-assisted suicide, something timely so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador on key issues you will be challenged on. So call us right now at 1-800-2-REASON and ask for Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free. Or go to our website at str.org and ask for Solid Ground. While you're at it, you can download some of the over 300 free reports you'll also find there. That's 1-800-2-REASON and on the web, str.org.
The Apostle Paul knew well the effect on those who engaged in empty chatter as they spread the virus of false knowledge. They went astray. So while entrusting the treasure of truth to his disciple Timothy and encouraging him to entrust it to other faithful men, Paul also exhorted him to guard the treasure. Paul's word guard comes from the activity or office of a watchman whose job it is to protect those who are asleep from harm. It implies a deliberate, conscious act and demands discernment in knowing what it is that has been placed under our care. Guard the treasure was Paul's final message to Timothy before Paul's death. It reflected the heartbeat of his ministry. Stand to Reason has chosen it as our theme this year because it reflects the heartbeat of our ministry. Guard the treasure which has been entrusted to you. To learn more about Stand to Reason and how we are training Christian ambassadors to guard the treasure, visit us at www.str.org. Our website is full of unique and useful training materials to train you to be an effective ambassador for Christ. That's www.str.org.
Greg Kochel back with you here at Stand to Reason. And I have my verse here, so if you got a pen or pencil, write this down because this makes the point I was just talking about. It is John 14, verse 23. Jesus answered and said to him, "If anyone loves me, he will keep my word, and my Father will love him, and we will come to him and make our abode with him." So this love that's being spoken of here is a love that comes after those who follow him keep his word. But there is another love that God has for us before. Greater love is no man than this, than he lay down his life for his friend, right? Romans 5, even while we are yet sinners, Christ died for us. So the love was there before he died, yet there is a love that comes only afterwards when we follow him and keep his commandments. Obviously, they're not the same two loves. There are different ways God loves different people. I don't know how you can avoid that. John 14:23. Okay, to Bristol, Connecticut. And Dan, you're a trooper. Thanks for waiting.
Greg, this is like the biggest thrill ever.
Well, thank you.
I just heard about you on Hank Hanegraaff a few years ago. I've been to your ABC studies. It's great stuff. Thanks.
Great. I'm glad to hear that. Thanks.
I was listening to your rebroadcast last week where you did your talk on the emerging church, and if I'm not mistaken, was that the same talk you gave at the Master Series this year?
I think what you heard, did you guys play, was it a tape being played, a teaching tape? Was that the shorter one that I gave? No.
Yes, because you did a half an hour interview with somebody and half an hour talk, or half, I mean half.
Well, the content is the same. I can't remember if it was just from the Master Series or not, because I've given that talk at different times, and I've actually tightened it up a little bit more from the Master Series, but it's the Master Series talk that's available on the website right now
and
on the homepage.
The Master Series from this year. It's
good.
Good stuff.
Same ideas. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, there was something you said in there that sounded interesting. You were responding to the Catholic doctrine of inclusivism, and you responded by saying that it diminishes the urgency of preaching the gospel.
Right.
And I agree with you on that, by the way.
Right. The idea that other religions lead to equally to Jesus and God removes the urgency for people proclaiming the message that they must hear.
Right. Right. Well, my question would be is if this sense of urgency is in any way a test for truth, well, how does this cast out in terms of Calvinism, in terms of, at least with respect to, look for the word, irresistible grace and limited atonement.
Right, right.
Now, for disclosure's purposes, I'm still kind of wrestling with this whole issue of Arminianism versus
sure.
Calvinism, and I'm guessing you can say I'm erring on the side of Arminianism, at least with respect to those two doctrines. I'd rather be wrong about that on the Arminian side than on the Calvinist side, you know what I'm saying?
Well, I know what you're saying. I don't know what virtue accrues as a result of it, but I think that's what you're getting at here in your question, because if you're a Calvinist, then this takes away the motivation for you to share the gospel at all.
Not the motivation, just the sense of urgency. It diminishes the sense of urgency.
Yeah. The reason I said that inclusivism diminishes the sense of urgency is because there is nothing about the gospel per se that must be believed for people to be to benefit from it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
How that's not the case on the Calvinistic side, because it is everything about the gospel that must be believed in order to benefit from it, and without that gospel, people are perishing.
Right.
I actually don't know any Calvinists who are not urgent about the issue of communicating the gospel. It is just the understanding that in communicating that it is God's. It is completely God's responsibility to accomplish his purposes through the communication of that gospel.
Right.
But the purposes will not be accomplished apart from the communication.
Mm-hmm.
So the way it's normally put is that God ordains not only the ends, but also the means, and the means are just as vital as the ends.
Right.
The illustration I give is the illustration of Abraham and Sarah when they were promised a child 1 year hence.
Right.
Did that decrease the urgency of Abraham jumping in the sack with Sarai? And I would say no, that was still required. And without that, there wouldn't have been a baby.
Mm-hmm.
And by the same token, I think that I understand how people can say this because they raise the issue frequently, but it just doesn't seem to work out that way. And I think proper understanding of the relationship of means to ends resolves that problem.
Right,
so.
And I'm not taking issue with whether or not there's an urgency there still. Only it just, if I'm understanding it correctly, and it may not be, the sense of urgency as a test for truth doesn't seem, you know, I mean.
No, I understand what you're saying, and I'm thinking about that myself a little bit. Would I feel as urgent about sharing Christ with everybody if I thought that they had to decide and I was going to persuade them and it was my persuading of them that made the difference, as opposed to, God was responsible for making the difference. I guess I would have more responsibility on my own shoulders. I would look at it differently. But
that's not where I'm coming from. Maybe I'm overstating when I say Arminia, just in the sense that people have a choice. I have a responsibility to tell them, and then it's up to God to draw them. Maybe I'm mixing that up, the whole thing up.
Maybe it'd be better for me to put it this way, and this might repair the problem. Had I said it removes the need. If you're an inclusivist, it removes the need of communicating the gospel, and that is harmful to the gospel.
And that makes more sense.
Calvinism doesn't remove the need.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So let me just amend it that way, and that'll probably help.
Yes. Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Connor, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Dan. Bye. Take care. Bye-bye. Let's go to Jonathan in San Diego. Jonathan, welcome to Stand to Reason. Greg Hochul, hi.
Hey, Greg. How you doing?
Good.
Hey, Greg, you were on Hank Hanegraaff's this week, Bible Answer Man.
Yeah, they replayed the tactics
right.
interview. Glad to hear that they did.
And there was something. I have a question about one of the tactics, but before I do, you also made – you were talking about self-refuting arguments.
Right.
And you had given three examples of Fred Beckwith said about silence and reincarnation. How did those go again?
Let's see. I used to believe in reincarnation, but that wasn't a former life.
Yeah.
Now that statement, of course, says I don't believe in reincarnation. I do believe in reincarnation, and so there's the contradiction there. That's one of them. Ask me about my vow of silence. Well, the minute you ask somebody to ask about the vow of silence, it's obvious that you violated the vow, so you don't have a vow of silence. That's the, you know, these are kind of like comical things too, but they're meant to give people a little bit of sense of it and also to get people chuckling.
Right. Okay, and you also, you were talking about the steamroller tactic.
Yes, uh-huh.
And, you know, you kind of explained what, you know, it's about people who are loud and abrasive.
And interrupt.
You're really told how to use the tactic.
Say it again. I didn't tell how to use it.
Yeah, you just kind of said. You just kind of said.
Oh yeah, I guess the I remember that now. And the interview was abbreviated. I couldn't get to it, and because you know, when you're being interviewed, somebody else is directing the conversation. I think we went to callers after that before I got into it. There are three steps to dealing with a steamroller. A steamroller is a person who overwhelms you with attitude and interruptions, especially. He's an interrupter. People have heard who listen to the show in the past know when I get on with a steamroller because you can never get going. They're always cutting you off. And so there are three steps. The first step is to stop him and negotiate. So it's kind of an easy thing. It's just, oh, hold on, I'm not quite finished yet. You know, or just a minute, you ask a question, you want me to answer it? Fine, then I'll let you respond. Is that all right with you? So you have a little negotiation there. So you stop the forward movement and you negotiate. The second step, if this doesn't work, the first step doesn't work, and it usually will, but if the first step doesn't work, they say they'll listen, but then they break trust with you, or sometimes you can't even get to the first step because they keep cutting you off before you even you know, try to negotiate. Then you do the same thing, but much more aggressively. You say, now, look, I'm trying to answer your question, and I'd like to because it's an important thing, but, you know, you keep interrupting me. If you keep interrupting me, I'm not going to be able to answer it. So why don't we – how about if we have this agreement? You talk, and I'll listen to you, and I'll be polite with you. Then when you're done talking, it's my turn to talk, and it's your turn to be polite. And then we'll reverse, and we'll have a conversation. Now, I need to know whether that's okay. Because if it's not okay, then there's no sense talking anymore. Now, notice how the second was kind of like the first, but it was more direct and intense. And that's because that's the only thing that will be available to you to stop the steamroller. The first time, it's just a little aside, and it says, oh, hold on, I'm not quite done yet. Is that all right? Okay, then you go in, and then you let the person back in, so you keep your own word. Second time, you have to address the interruptions directly as rudeness. And the third step, you stop them, step one. You shame them, step two. That's the more direct one. And third, if that doesn't work, you leave them. You don't throw your pearls before swine. You don't let them trample all over you. You're talking past this person anyway. It's not going to help anybody. You just say, okay, I guess we have a difference of opinion. Fine. Bye. And I mean that. And I've done that. I've walked away from people.
Even if you're on a radio interview, would you do that?
Yeah, sure. But usually on the radio, I can use the second step with more effectiveness. And what happens is if they don't buy it, then they walk. Because usually at that point, I'm a little – and people know because they've heard me before on this one. I'm upset. You know, I'm saying, okay, and I'm pretty intense with them. And sometimes I'll pull the pot down, the potentiator, which means that nobody can hear them. Okay? I slide that thing down. They're not hung up on, but they can't squawk anymore. And then I explain to them, here's the way it's going to work because it's my – and I could do this on the radio. I said, this is my show. We're going to have a conversation. We're not going to have a one-sided interruption fest. So are you on board or not? Then I bring the pot up, and a lot of times I hear a dial tone. And so they hung up on themselves, you know. But if they want to play games – I mean, if they want to play ball, after I told them they can't play games – then that's fine, and I'll have a civil conversation with him. So, but I will leave him if I have to.
Thank you.
Okay, Jonathan, thank you for the call. And that leaves David. We made it, David. We got 3 minutes, or two and a half or so. Thank you for waiting.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, just briefly, I wanted to bring up the aspect that with respect to law, whether it be implied or implied explicitly or not,
mm-hmm.
If you accept the benefits that somebody is providing you, whether those benefits have been expressly given to you,
mm-hmm.
When you accept those benefits, you are subject to the conditions of those benefits. And that's why I'm probably of a disagreement with respect to marriage licenses than you might be. And the sense is that what the state does is they take license with any of those types of certificates, whether they be marriage licenses, birth certificates, it makes no difference.
Okay.
The state takes license with those.
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by the state takes license with them. These things are, well, the birth certificate's not a license. It's just a formal announcement that you've been born in a certain place at a certain date. So what the marriage license is a government. It does two things. It's a stamp of approval. It's a giving a license to. It's an acknowledgement of, and that you then fall underneath the prohibitions and the privileges of that relationship with the state. Now, you don't have to get a license, but then you don't get the privileges and whatever that come with it. So I'm not sure where the area of disagreement is.
My argument would be is that the so-called privileges and benefits that the state offers in exchange for that marriage license, or any particular license for that matter, are not necessarily to the benefit of anybody but the state.
Well, I don't argue with that. My argument is with regard to same-sex marriage is that the state has a legitimate interest in getting involved in things that it has an interest in. And if it benefits them, if they're concerned in this case with the next generation, then they have an interest in licensing and regulating and privileging the kinds of relationships that characteristically produce the next generation. So I'm with you on this so far.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is that there should be no certificates of marriage in that sense. In the sense that, because what we're doing is, and by the way, I would disagree with you. We don't live in a constitutional republic anymore. We live in a direct democracy.
Well, you're moving into a totally different area right now.
Right.
We were talking about same-sex marriage,
am.
So let's stick with that because we got about 15 seconds to go.
Just briefly, such a short of time, it really makes it difficult to put a thought together.
Well, there you go. I'm sorry. We're out of time. Well, you made some good points. I think I understood the point that you're making insofar as you were able to do so. And maybe we'll talk another time and we can cash this out a little bit more. That's it for this show, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for spending part of your afternoon with me. And I look forward to next Sunday. I'll be back with you and we'll be doing more of the same. Okay. In the meantime, be a good ambassador for Christ if you're a follower of Christ. And if you're not a follower of Christ, I hope you think about Christianity, because I think Christianity is worth thinking about. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Take care, friends. Bye-bye.